Close. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. In a few minutes, we're going to do a follow-up to our recent program on the efficacy of testing as a means of measuring performance in schools. But first, we want to get an update on some historic goings-on in Columbia. Following the recent shooting at a church in Charleston, South Carolina, Governor Nikki Haley did something that had previously been unthinkable. She called for the removal of the Confederate flag from the State House grounds. And yesterday, the South Carolina Senate voted 37-3 on a second reading of a bill calling for removal of the flag. WFAE's Ben Bradford has been following this from Columbia, and he joins us now from that city, from the capital city in South Carolina. Welcome to the program, Ben.
Hi, Mike.
This vote was not even close, 37-3. Was that a surprise?
I don't think it was a surprise. The Charleston Post-Gazette, the local Charleston paper, did a poll of all lawmakers, and we knew that the Senate needed a two-thirds majority, and we knew that they were well over that. And you got to remember that, you know, one of their own died in the Charleston shooting, Clemente Pinckney, who was a state senator and was also the pastor at the church where the shooting happened. You know, that was one of the big impetuses for this action.
Several hours of debate preceded the vote. I think the three senators who voted against this laid out their case as to why they were against this. But it was the debate simply pro forma, or was there a possibility that some people could be persuaded to vote in the opposite direction?
Well, I think that we knew that this was gonna go through. There was some question about some of the amendments. Senator Lee Bright, who was sort of the most vocal opponent of this, he tried to get it to be a voter referendum that would go on the next election ballots so that South Carolina voters could directly decide. There was another move to make the flag go up once a year on I think a Confederate Flag Day. And so there were those sorts of efforts. But the idea that this was going to pass, even they were ultimately resigned to. And I think it was an opportunity in the 6 hours of debate for them to really lay out all of their arguments and just get on the record.
And as that debate was going on in the Senate yesterday, there was another debate going on outside the Capitol building around the Confederate Memorial. Talk about the atmosphere outside the building among people who want the flag to stay and among those who want the flag to go.
Sure, absolutely. You know, when I got there in the morning, there was one person holding a sign that said, "Honk if you want the flag down." And then an hour later, there were four people standing next to him waving Confederate flags. And it just kind of grew throughout the day. And, you know, so it was about probably a couple dozen on each side. And it wasn't necessarily the same volume or amount of protests that we saw right after the Charleston shooting when Governor Haley called for the flag to come down. But it definitely got heated sometimes. There was, you know, one of the men that wanted the flag to stay up and pushed a woman who wanted it to go down. The police had to intervene, and you had that. So, obviously it's a very heated issue, and I think that, you know, when I talk to those people, you heard a lot of the same arguments. I think that, you know, it's very much a binary issue for a lot of people, which is that, you know, either you believe that this is a divisive symbol of hatred and a split country and lack of inclusiveness, or that it's heritage and honor and history and, you know, Southern pride and those kind of things there. And there's very few people that are involved in this debate that, you know, that fall within the middle of those two extremes.
So the Senate voted on the second reading yesterday, 37-3. The vote now heads for a third reading, or heads to a third reading in the Senate in about an hour.
That's right. The third reading, second vote, because this is legislation and therefore the ugliest of sausage.
So they will vote again in about 2 hours.
That's exactly right. And then from there, and that should pass. I mean, it's, you know, the third reading is usually almost a formality. And then it'll go to the House. And we know that Governor Haley, if she gets the bill, will sign it. But what will happen in the House is a little bit more of a question. That same poll that I mentioned earlier from the Charleston newspaper shows that it does have the two-thirds majority support that it will need, but by about one vote. And that's within the margin of error. You know, I mean, the amount of arm twisting needed to to pass the thing. And then also the Speaker of the House, Jay Lucas, he gets to decide, you know, what process this takes. Does it go into a committee first or does it go straight to the floor? And he has said that he wants to do it, you know, quickly, but he hasn't said what he wants to have happen. So there's a lot of uncertainty there about how that will go.
Could the political fallout for those who vote to take the flag down be greater in the House or Senate or about the same?
I don't know the answer to that. I think that obviously the breakdown of House districts, you can see that it's a much tougher issue there. I mean, it's really clear that's much more divisive there.
There is a fear among a lot of people that if you remove the flag, people will next call for the removal of Confederate memorials, and already there have been incidents of defacing portraits and memorials in both North and South Carolina that deal with Confederate heroes. Has there been any discussion in the House or the Senate as the legislature debate has unfolded about that as they vote on the flag issue?
Yes, that was absolutely one of the arguments that the that opponents of the measure, both inside and outside, made. They kind of had, you know, sort of the slippery slope argument. Where will it end if we take? You know, we've already moved it once, because you got to remember that the flag moved 15 years ago. The NAACP led protests and an economic boycott that still continues right now to get the flag down, and it was flying at the time on top of the state capitol, along with the American flag and the South Carolina state flag, and the compromise was that they were going to move it to the edge of the capitol grounds to its current location. So opponents really feel like they're people who want the flag to stay up feel like they're under attack, like they've already conceded some, right, and now they're being asked to give more.
It seems fairly certain that the Senate will vote to remove the flag today, sometime before noon today, and then it will go to the House, as you said. What if the House says no? What happens then?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that it'll be a test for Governor Haley. Obviously, she's become sort of the face of pushing for this measure. And I think that everybody at this point kind of expects that it will go through, and it's a matter of time. But you're absolutely right. It's anything could happen.
WFAE's Ben Bradford reporting on this unfolding story from Columbia, South Carolina. You'll be there all day today for the Senate vote, and we'll look forward to hearing what happens from you later on WFAE. Thank you, Ben.
Thank you.
And now on to our follow-up discussion on education. A couple of weeks ago, the state superintendent of education and others joined us to talk about testing in North Carolina, its efficacy, frequency, and the sheer number of tests. A task force has been looking into testing and how it's used to judge performance of students and teachers. And at the time of our conversation, their preliminary findings were about to be released. We heard from a lot of different people about that conversation, particularly from teachers and administrators. Normally, teachers have a difficult time participating in this program because they are in class, but it's summer, and that is not the case, so we invited some to join us today for an educator roundtable discussion on a wide range of topics like best practices, school redesign, common core standards, and yes, testing and more. Joanna Scamizzi is a biology teacher at Independence High School and in her ninth year at CMS. She's been recognized as a MECED Teacher of Excellence and has developed mentor programs and has been part of an after-school lab program through Pfeiffer University. Thank you for being here this morning. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Collins.
Oh, no, that's my father. Ben Carey Owens is a mathematics and physics teacher at Tri-County Early College High School in Murphy, North Carolina. He started his trek to Charlotte, I think, sometime in May. He finally arrived today. After an 18-year career with DuPont, he left the corporate world to teach in rural Appalachia and is passionate, he says, about changing the status quo on education by better connecting the classroom to what happens in today's global knowledge base economy. Thank you for being here, too.
Good to be here, Mike.
Nancy Gardner is a teacherpreneur. Now, there's a new word at the Center for Teaching Quality. All of these folks are involved in the Center for Teaching Quality. That's a hybrid position, the teacherpreneur position, in which she taught at Mooresville High School in the daytime, in the morning, and then worked at the Center for Teaching Quality in the afternoon on teacher leadership initiatives. She's also spent a lot of time teaching in the CMS system and at the Mooresville graded schools. Welcome back.
Thank you so much, Mike.
And Doyle Nicholson is principal at Davie County High School and is beginning his 24th year in education, having taught high school math for 14 years at Forbush High School. He was named Yadkin County Teacher of the Year in 2005, Davie County Assistant Principal of the Year in 2013, and was named principal at Davie County High in 2014. You're still alive after all that time in the classroom.
I am. Thank you.
What's the biggest challenge facing teachers today in the classroom? I'll hear from all of you about that very quickly.
Well, as the older veteran on the team, since I've been in the classroom for over 30 years, I think what it is a shifting in what the expectations are for the teachers and combined with what our students need. As I've seen as we've moved into the 21st century, we have a different skill set that our students need in order to be productive citizens. And then we as teachers need to be on top of our game in moving forward to try to meet the needs of those students. The job, I think, is one that I have learned over the years is a craft, mm-hmm. an artistry. And the more you do it, the more you realize how complicated it is.
So if you're the oldest person on the panel, I'm not saying that you are. I'm using your definition. Let's go to the youngest person on the panel. What do you see as the biggest challenges?
Sure. I've taught in Charlotte-Mecklenburg my whole career for 9 years. And I think that the biggest challenge for teachers is a challenge that many of us face in our lives, which is the digital world of so much information and how do I make sense of all of this information? At the beginning of the year, I get a ton of data about how my students did in previous years and how they're expected to do this year. And there are hundreds of lesson plans that have a sticker on them that say they are aligned. And so I think the biggest challenge is for teachers to really be smart and for administrators to really craft time for teachers to work not only within their schools but also with schools across the nation. There are tons of organizations like the Center for Teaching Quality that purposefully try to create opportunities for teachers to collaborate because they know that best practices don't happen in one classroom. They need to be shared across all the classrooms.
And then we have a longtime teacher and a first-time principal, although having been an assistant principal, that gave you a little taste of what it's like. You've been on both sides of the coin here. So what's the challenge in your mind?
What I see as a challenge is we expect teachers to do more and more and more with less. Budgets have not really kept up with the demands that we expect teachers to do in the classroom. Also, from an administrator perspective, hiring and keeping highly qualified teachers in the classroom has been a challenge over the past few years.
And speaking of highly qualified teachers, here's a guy who left the cushy world of DuPont to become a teacher, a physics teacher. What do you see as the, and that was it an eye-opening experience? Did you perceive challenges to be different than what you have discovered them in fact to be?
Sure, I admit I came in with a little bit of I was a bit naive. And thought I could somehow change the world. And although I am making some significant headway in that regard, especially locally at my school, I have been able to see that there are significant headwinds in terms of a status quo model. And I think that's what Nancy alluded to a second ago, is that, for us to say that we're challenging and preparing students for the 21st century and yet are using tools and models that were, relatively unchanged for the last 100 years. That, to me, is a big challenge from a cultural standpoint that we've got to address.
When you all talk about the models that have been in place for 100 years, what are you talking about? Teacher-lecturer models?
We've certainly seen a shift from teacher-centered classrooms where the teacher's at the front of the room and the students are all in rows. I imagine, Mike, when you were in third grade, you were in rows.
Absolutely.
I was, too, at Davidson Elementary. And now we're doing more collaborative work in our classroom. The teacher becomes a coach, and the students are involved in their own learning.
That's Nancy Gardner, one of our teachers here, and we have four of them in the room. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Carolina Neurosurgery and Spine Associates, celebrating 75 years of providing neurosurgery, physiatry, imaging, and physical therapy services for patients with brain and spine disorders. Details at cnsa.com. The number of older Americans is growing. 13% of the population is 65 and older right now, and cities across the country are beginning to prepare for the coming boom, making a city age-friendly. isn't just the right thing to do, it's necessary to ensure the future economic health of all generations. At least, that is what one of our guests will tell us tomorrow when we talk about just what it takes to make a city age-friendly and about the economic benefits of doing so. That's tomorrow at 9.
The next Diane Rehm Show. Sex offender registries are designed to protect the public from pedophiles and others who've committed sexual crimes. But some say those guilty of much lesser offenses don't belong on the list. Sex offender registries and calls for reform.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking, doing a follow-up program on our teacher discussion with the state superintendent of schools from a couple of weeks ago, but we have four teachers in our midst today. Nancy Gardner, teacherpreneur at the Center for Teacher Equality and a teacher in the Mooresville schools. Doyle Nicholson is a principal at Davie County High School. Joanna Scamizzi is a biology teacher at Independence High, and Ben Carey Owens is a math and physics teacher at Tri-County Early College High up in the mountains of North Carolina. Let's talk about testing first, because that's what we spent an hour talking about a couple of weeks ago with people on this who are involved in the task force that's looking into this. I know you all have had an opportunity to hear that show. What, if anything, that you heard on that program surprised you or resonated with you, either positively or negatively? Who would like to go first?
I think I'm pleased with the direction that Dr. Atkinson's talking about in terms of fewer tests. My main concern, and some of this came up with Michael Anders at the end, is
he was the teacher involved,
is teachers getting the feedback on those tests so that they can make their instruction.
That was actually very surprising and astoundingly ignorant, it seems to me. Not he wasn't ignorant, but the fact that the teachers don't get any feedback on the tests that have been given. They're operating in the blind. Why would that be?
Part of it is the actual grading of the test, and just the whole structure of testing administrations in a high school, as I'm sure Doyle can speak to, is an enormous task. So fewer tests is definitely going to be helpful. My main concern is that we need really good tests that are aligned to the standards. Our standards are rich and complex, and
Why aren't these tests aligned to the standards now?
Well, for example, in English language arts, I'm teaching reading, writing, speaking, listening, and language. These are multiple choice tests. It's really hard to do speaking, listening, and writing with multiple choice. So already I'm missing out on a good portion of my standards. I think it's what Michael also alluded to, the fact that we need more performance-based, product-based assessments.
There's two things I'd like to say, one of which is so much of what the state tries to decide is influenced by on the national level. So when you look at the ESEA Act, the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, there's an amendment called the SMART Act, which was proposed by two senators, Baldwin and Brown, who are looking to really give states funding to intelligently look at their tests and make sure that they're not overlapping, that we're not giving so many tests. And I was a little concerned when they talked about giving formative tests during the year, which most teachers already do. And so I got a little scared about, well, if you're now giving state formatives, how does that balance with the formatives that I get to give? And do I give pretests for that? And I was a little worried.
I remember the first standardized test I ever took, because it was the first time I had to kick a number two pencil and circle, stay in the lines and circle that little thing. It was very hard for a third or fourth grader to do that. But anyway, prior to that and even after that, most of the tests I took were tests that were made up by the teacher. Which the teacher graded. It didn't go off to some computer in the sky and come back 6 weeks later. Do we still do that? And why isn't that sufficient? You guys are on the front line. You know what your students don't know, and you know what they do know, and one would presume you know all that, and you know where they need help. So why aren't those tests sufficient?
Well, I think those types of tests, or the teacher-generated tests, are indeed sufficient if we have our priorities straight. For me, The whole testing issue is it seems to be an environment where the testing is driving the instruction rather than quality driving instruction. So the tests that I give, for example, are very similar to what was discussed on the previous by the teacher in the previous mm-hmm. program, are performance-based. My classroom is completely project-based, where students are collaborating every day, solving problems every day, things that are relevant to what's happening out there in the real world. And I am assessing formatively throughout that process to see where the weaknesses are and where I need to intervene on an individual basis. That's good quality teaching, and that, fortunately, is what I see in a lot of classrooms, and you can't standardize that.
I read through a lot of material that you supplied our producer yesterday, and a lot of it was very eye-opening. You said that this fixation, and that's your word, this fixation on testing has led to effectively lowering our teaching standards. How so?
Well, I'll give an example. Is I absolutely refuse to do any test prep, as it were, where I sit students in front of released exams or in front of a computer and do multiple choice testing. Because I believe fundamentally in my heart that I am lowering the quality of instruction for these students who are going to be graduating in a year or two and out there in that real world on a college campus or in a job. And I am therefore lowering my efficiency in terms of the level of instruction that I'm doing. And unfortunately, if we have a fixation, my word, yes, on testing, we tend to take an easy way out where we will want to, as teachers, try to cover all of our standards by doing things like printing out release tests.
Well, you kind of have to, don't you? You're being judged by how these students perform. And if they can't take the test well, then you're in trouble. You are in trouble, not them, you.
And let me add that Ben is a risk taker, and that wouldn't be possible for all teachers across the state or across the nation to be able to do that. But he has a grip on his vision and what he wants his students to be able to do. But that takes nerve to be mm-hmm. able to say, okay, I'm going to abandon this pacing moving forward, and I'm going to do it the way I think kids can learn.
And Doyle, you've been on both sides of this. I'm sure when you were in the classroom, you had one set of opinions, and now you see the world differently because you're being demanded. Things are being demanded of you as a principal.
The one thing I notice is there seems to be a disconnect between what we expect of teachers and then how we evaluate the performance. If you look at the evaluation system that we use to evaluate teachers, we expect them to use student collaboration. We expect them to use a variety of assessments. And then when we get to the end product, we assess the same way we always did. So what we expect of teachers doesn't match how we're assessing our students and our teachers now.
You're the principal, as I've said, at Davie County High. I don't know that they can hear us this morning, so you can speak freely. If you had no one to answer to above you, no school board, no state superintendent of education, as the principal of your high school, how would things change?
I would like to see the assessment of teacher effectiveness based on what the standards are for teachers. I would like to see somehow us create some type of assessment that assesses student collaboration, the thought process of the students, not the end result. You know, if a student incorrectly adds 2 and 3 together on a state exam, then they miss the question. But that doesn't really determine if they understood the concepts or not. So developing some type of assessment that really goes to the thought process of the students.
Do you have ideas about that, all four of you? I mean, how in the absence of standardized tests and the plethora of standardized tests that come your way that are used to judge student performance and are used to assess your performance as teachers in the classroom, is there a better way, another way to do this?
Sure. I recently had my eyes really opened by a colleague of mine, Dr. Michelle Steffen, who teaches math pedagogy at UNC Charlotte. And she really opened my eyes about, I know a lot about classroom teaching, but I don't honestly know a lot about assessment design. So while I like to create things to use in my own classroom, there are a ton of principles about quality assessment development that I'm just now learning to use. So I would love to see those assessments out there. I know that the SAT is being redesigned to be what's now being called assessment for learning instead of just assessment of learning, mm-hmm. meaning at the end of the test, you learned something. You didn't just demonstrate your learning. You also walk away from the test going, imagine in a biology class, they're being tested on animal behavior, but they learn they read a paragraph about shark feeding patterns, something that's super relevant to the state of North Carolina right now.
Yeah.
And they walk away knowing something more than what they entered the test, but they still demonstrated their own learning. So those are the type of tests that are out there that are being developed that I think the state of North Carolina is really a little slow to latch onto.
And again, Ben, you've said some things about how we test to hold teachers accountable. You said that accountability has not been wrong. It's been one-sided. You say you don't hold employees accountable for things they don't control. Is that what's happening when we used testing and test results as a measure of teacher performance?
Right. Well, as was mentioned on the last program, the test results are now measuring, or they're helping to, or maybe not so much helping, but we're using them to label students, using them to label teachers, using them to label schools. So when we're using the same tool to measure or to label three different things, that may be a misappropriation of how we need to be doing it. We need to define what is excellence and find the tool then that is the best measure for measuring that excellence. So for example, you know, I think there are many teachers out there who would be willing to say, you know, send a subject matter expert into my room and do a evaluation of what I am doing. Do you see students collaborating? Do you see students solving problems? Do you see students adapting to new situations and learning? And if you see that, that's evidence of good quality teaching.
You teach math and physics. The solving problems is part of what you teach students to do. You teach English, Nancy. Solving problems, is that a thing that you do in the classroom for
with our
English?
With our new standards, I would say that we've all become better problem solvers, or that's what we're trying to focus on for our 21st century students. We're going to use literature and informational literacy, but we're also going to help students learn to be better critical readers. That is a skill that I find my current students are sorely lacking in because they are bombarded with information. They want quick fixes. They're also very good at taking multiple choice tests. They've learned to bubble very easily, and they get frustrated when they don't have the four answers in front of them. So their problem solving is a little bit different in that we're asking them to dig deeply into text.
Let's talk about that for a second, because I have a friend who's a teacher, and that's one of the complaints that his students have. If there's a question on the test that's not multiple choice or true or false, if it's a test that requires them to, or a question that requires an answer to be written out, they get very upset because there are no clues as to what that answer might be. Have we trained people to have a crutch, to not really need to learn the material, because you have a 25% chance of getting it right on a multiple choice test with four answers?
I would say absolutely. And I don't give multiple choice test or true false test. I always say their test should be vuja de, not deja vu, like something they've never experienced before. And I want to see what they know. They may give me an answer that I had never thought of. Yeah. In relation to a piece of literature. But if it's connected to text and they've used evidence from the text, I'm going to give them credit.
As a principal who's over all these teachers who have to comply with state and federal regulations and also the regulations that you and your school board put into place, is there freedom for teachers to do that sort of thing? In other words, it's very easy to administer a multiple choice test where the answer is clear. But when you have freedom to verbalize your answer in writing, you may have a point of view that the teacher didn't know, but that's equally correct because it's your opinion. Do you allow that?
Yeah, actually, we firmly believe in the engineering design process in our classrooms, where you think it's more designed for science, where you make a hypothesis and then you test it out and then revise. But we encourage that in all of our subjects, and it's perfect in English class because it's about the process and not the end result. And it's about getting a better product by looking at your errors and then going back and fixing
it. It's about process, not end result. And that is something that I think employers want in the 21st century. They want people who are critical thinkers and who can go through the process to get to the end result. Does the way we teach and test encourage that activity in the classroom?
That's where I would say, and again, the word fixation with testing. And this is not just in North Carolina. This is nationwide. And one could even argue it's even worse in some countries, India or China, whatever. But my issue, for us to stay an innovative powerhouse as a nation, as a state, we've got to do a better job of connecting the skills, like Nancy mentioned before, you know, the ability for students to access and analyze information, to collaborate, to communicate orally and through written means. Those types of skills are what's going to define us as a future economic powerhouse. And so the testing needs to be more focused on those types of issues and less on the rudimentary rote knowledge memorization, multiple choice model that we have used for too many years.
And Joanna Scamizza, you're a biology teacher. Science is all about process and experimentation and going down dead-end roads only to discover that what your hypothesis is wrong. How do you test an understanding and a knowledge of that?
Sure, Mike. Well, one of the things that I've learned through organizations like America Achieves, which I'm a fellow with, is that we have to really think about how the brain learns. And some reasons why I actually like multiple choice tests in some ways is that there's something called Bloom's taxonomy, which is this ranking of how well a student learns something. And if they don't know the word mitochondria, then they can't really demonstrate higher levels of learning that include that word. So really well-designed multiple-choice tests actually take into account, well, let me ask a really straightforward question first, and then let me ask more and more and more complex questions so that I can really diagnose where is the student in their process of learning. And some, you know, multiple-choice questions could be really complex. Imagine asking, you know, a patient has been diagnosed with X, what should the doctor do next? That could be a multiple-choice question, but the student still has to do a lot of analysis to reach the multiple-choice. The advantage of multiple-choice is you can get your data back really quickly.
Yeah.
When you look at redesigned AP tests, they have a mix. They have multiple choice, short answer, and then really long essay. And to me, that's the best design.
Ben, back to you, because you're a troublemaker.
You
say that one reason you became a teacher is because when you were at DuPont, you were a customer of the country's education system, and you saw firsthand how high school and college graduates were underperforming. So when you got into education, did you uncover why?
Well, again, I think it's back to what we've been discussing before, is we are trying to use tools, models, systems that were designed in a large extent, you know, in the early 1900s to prepare students for 21st century workplace.
What's the difference? People have difficulty understanding the difference. It worked for them in the 1950s. Why doesn't it work today? What's different?
Well, in the 1950s, one, you know, here in North Carolina could, you know, perhaps have a whole different array of job opportunities than exist today. You know, we had a furniture industry, a textile industry, more agriculture and things like that. And honestly, those jobs don't exist today. So we have
didn't require collaboration. They didn't require critical
indeed.
Thinking skills. You turned a widget. You hammered a nail.
Right. If you worked for a textile mill, you went in and you had the bobbins. You knew what you needed to do. You did that every day. That doesn't happen today.
So you're not just teaching the subject matter of whatever your discipline is. You're teaching people how to work through problems.
Indeed. For me, and again, I think for many teachers within the CTQ, we are focusing on the skills, not necessarily just the curriculum.
And CTQ is Center for Teaching Quality. We have to take a break. We'll come back with more in a moment, including some teacher reactions who are listeners out there. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Blumenthal Performing Arts, presenting Paula Poundstone July 11th at Knight Theater. A regular panelist on NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, she has her own distinctive brand of wry, intelligent, and witty comedy. Tickets at 704-372-1000. Sex offender registries are designed to protect the public from pedophiles and others who have committed sexual crimes, but some say those guilty of much lesser offenses don't belong on the list. Sex offender registries and calls for reform, the topic of the conversation in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show. And if you'd like to join our conversation, you can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or look for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter. We're coming right back.
¶¶ Ah, Silicon Valley, hotbed of innovation and product launches and conferences.
It could be easy for entrepreneurs to get lost into going to conferences and networking instead of focusing on their product and how to make that better.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Some people get to have all the fun. Not next time on Marketplace from 8 p.m.
Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about teaching once again, which we do frequently on this program because it's such a top of mind and an important issue. But for the first time in a long time, we actually have four teachers in our midst, the experts talking about what they do as opposed to what they should do from people who are not doing it. Nancy Gardner is a teacherpreneur and with the Center for Teaching Quality and also an English teacher at the Mooresville Graded Schools. Doyle Nicholson is the principal of Davie County High. Joanna Scamizzi is a biology teacher at Independence High, and Ben Carey Owens is a math and physics teacher at Tri-County Early College High. We asked teachers out there to join us via email and Facebook and Twitter and things like that, and here's what some of the things that have come in while we've been talking. Frank emails, he's a retired teacher, spent 35 years of his career in Charlotte. Why is it non-educators seem to think they know everything there is to know about teaching? A few more years of the current Raleigh gang, and you can kiss progress in NC goodbye. Now, I'm going to direct this to Ben, because you were outside of the teaching field. You got into the teaching field. I don't know whether you got into the teaching field because you had that opinion. You knew more than the teachers knew, and you could make it a better place if you just got there and took your world knowledge skills into the classroom. But respond to Frank's email.
Sure, and I, you know, I think I hear a lot of what Frank is saying when I talk to both teachers and non-educators out there. Part of my reason for getting in was indeed I have to admit that. But also I was the product of educators. I grew up. My dad was in education. My mom worked in the local administrative office for the school. So I had it in my blood. And to me, it was a way to take that experience in the corporate world, that experience from traveling all over the world, and being able to apply it in my case, in rural Appalachia with students who, in some cases, have never been to Atlanta, never been to the beach, never been to Charlotte. So providing them a way to see that, yes, it is a big world out there, and there are skills that you need in order to be able to collaborate with and compete with anyone on the planet.
And Doyle, you as a principal, I know you have to tread carefully here, but you've been in the classroom for a long time, and I'm sure you heard from people who never set foot in a classroom while you were in the classroom how you should be doing your job, and now you're a principal and you have to strike that careful balance. How helpful or hurtful are these people with the best of intentions?
Well, I think it's interesting because everybody has been a product of public education. So because they were a student in the system, they think that they become an expert. So they don't see the other side. I do think it's important, though, to have parent voice and other people's voices. I think if you just deal with teachers and administrators, then you're not getting the full spectrum and all the concerns. So I think it is important to have parent voice and opinion shared.
Not all teachers are good teachers. There's no question about that. There are a lot of bad teachers out there, and you do need people above them to assess their performance and weed out the bad ones and reward the good ones. We don't often reward the good ones enough. That's also a fact. But if teachers were in charge of their world, how would things in the classroom change? How would performance of students change? Do you think we would see better performance from students because you know what they need? I'm just asking the question. I'm not saying that's the truth.
You know, there are some schools, Mike, that have across the nation, and CTQ has been working with them, that are teacher-powered schools where the teachers actually make all the decisions. And there may be, if you can imagine, a number of hybrid roles where you're teaching and then you're an administrator. I know Doyle would love to be back in the classroom some. Or you're mentoring for part of your day with the new teacher, really mentoring where you're side-by-side with that person every day for their first year, much like a residency. The idea that teachers can lead our profession is the heart and soul of the Center for Teaching Quality.
You're very big, Doyle, I know, on the need for teacher leaders or leader teachers. I'm not sure which word comes first in that sentence.
Yeah, I think it's important that teachers go beyond the classroom, especially if they want to. Their voices, I think, are the most important in terms of forming educational policy. So we try to do things at CTQ to help equip those teachers to have a voice. We provide training for teachers to learn how to be a virtual community organizer and to spread their voice not only beyond their school but also nationwide. And so we really try to use that to impact teacher voice and impact into the education.
And I believe, Joanna, you've been described as a teacher leader. What made you want to take that role? Because, you know, leaders get their heads chopped off. It's a dangerous thing to be because you also have to have followers. People have to want to follow you. What was that like stepping into that position at first, and how have you seen it help you and or your students or your fellow teachers?
I think first and foremost, it's always really important to have someone who can really support you, a principal who really believes in you and is willing to be creative to let that happen. It's difficult for a principal to say, yes, please miss a whole week of instruction to go grade AP exams or go speak at a conference in Washington. That's really challenging for a principal. And so to have those sort of leaders who have been educated about that, that's the most important thing because it still makes you feel valuable. But it can be a little scary to leave what you really know in your classroom. But I think the colleagues that you meet and that you learn from, just sitting here today listening to these three colleagues, make me want to, you know, stash off after this and have lunch and talk a lot more. And that really not only impacts me, but my students, because I take so much back to them.
You quoted Elizabeth Warren in the break, Ben. give me that quote again.
I may not get it exactly right, but if you're not at the table, chances are you're on the menu. I think that's from her, and I saw that recently. So I like that quote. I'm gonna use it more.
And the reason I wanted to have you bring that up is because I know that, Nancy, you say that teachers want to be more involved in decision-making and want to have a bigger voice within the legislative process. Obviously, you want to be at the table when these things are being decided. What do you think the chances of that happening are?
Well, I'm always going to be optimistic that we can change the face of the nation. And I will be quick to add that that's not all teachers. And I will also say that we need help and support. Doyle mentioned the preparation to become a virtual community organizer. We are used to teaching in silos. It's a lonely profession. We barely have time to speak to our colleagues next door. And if there is time set aside for professional learning, it's at the end of the day or sandwiched in between other classes that you're teaching. So we need time and space, and we also need to support teachers in reminding us that we are the experts in our field. We forget that. We need that validation. We need to know how. We need help and support with writing, becoming more a part of social media, publishing.
You're fortunate because you're teaching in the Mooresville graded school system, which is among the best school systems in the state of North Carolina. That's not a well-known thing, I don't think, among a lot of people, because it's a very small system, but it is very good at what it does. Not everybody's in that situation. So I'm trying to think what the question was, because it's important. I think it's important people understand that the challenges that teachers face. If you're being judged on your performance by test results, there are a lot of students who come to school with very little preparation, very little parental oversight, extraordinary challenges in their personal lives, and their mindset is not ready to sit down and learn biology or physics because they had a problem at home or they didn't get enough sleep. How do you overcome those challenges? I don't know that you face that at Mooresville. Maybe you do.
Course we do, but because we have a large, diverse population, I think that's part of the complexity of our craft that I was referencing. And ultimately, at the end of the day, the students are the most important things in probably all of our hearts and minds. But in order to feel sustainability as a teacher or rejuvenated, to have that opportunity to interact with colleagues, whether it's virtually or at a conference or leading professional development for other teachers, it pays back and makes you feel renewed and refreshed.
You want parental involvement, obviously, but Joanna, you mentioned that you got a text from a parent at 11 o'clock at night, which required an answer, I suppose. What do you think people who are not teachers don't understand about your jobs?
I think a lot of times they maybe see us a little bit as babysitters. I continue to invite, and I hope that every parent who's listening will go visit their child's classroom multiple times next year. Pop in, drop in, say hi, watch your student, because I think that sometimes parents and teachers get an antagonist relationship that, oh, teachers only call home when the student is in trouble and parents only contact the teacher when the student is failing. And I think that what teachers would like to do is develop a stronger, positive
relationship.
Aren't
there parent-teacher nights and PTA meetings and things like that? Or people, is that passé now?
I'm a high school teacher, and I think it's definitely a more of an elementary school level that it happens a lot more. Some schools are really good at doing it, and I think all schools need to get better about not making parent night at 5 p.m. on a Wednesday, which is impossible for a lot of parents to come to.
I didn't get in trouble a lot when I was in school, but a couple of times I did, and I know that there was hell to pay when I did. My parents did not take my side of the equation over the teachers. The teacher was right, and I'd better get in line. Is that the case today?
Not completely. We do have helicopter parents who, and I teach seniors, so I see them very involved at times with the college application process and what the next step is. But part of our goal, since we teach students and not just content area, is to help our students become the drivers of their own education, to become self-sustaining learners, and learn how to let go. And that's a slippery slope between their learned helplessness, which we have all contributed to and their parents have contributed to, pushing them out of that nest, but also giving them the right support. Mm-hmm. And that's with every student who walks in the door. You're not quite sure where those two things meet. And you want to reach that kid where he is.
One of the challenges that's faced by everybody involved in education and everybody who at the legislative level who says they want to, and we'll take them at their word, improve education, is that we want to attract the best possible teachers and we want to retain them as well. How do you do that in this world today where teacher pay is low, where the respect for teachers has been declining, where they're not taken at their word, where they're not given a lot of control, where people are always looking over their shoulder? I'm painting a very bad – this is what I'm seeing from my point of view. I wouldn't want to do this for all the money in the world, and they're not paying you all the money in the world. What keeps teachers in place? What attracts good teachers? What demoralizes them?
Well, I think part of it is pay. I mean, you gotta bring that. Part of it is benefits, and the discussions that are ongoing about what we can do to enhance those aspects are critical. I think every teacher, however, comes to the profession with a passion. Now it may vary, but they are in the classroom because they want to make a difference, and they believe they can make a difference. And so I think, you know, in my case, for example, I love what I do. It's a fascinating thing every day to be able to go in and introduce students to, you know, math and physics in a way that they've never seen it before, so that they leave my classroom talking about it. I hear them talking at lunch about it, after school about it. That is, to me, so satisfying.
How do you do that?
Because I engage them in the process. I give them voice and choice in the process. I allow them to find ways that make it relevant to what they see in that world. And so kind of going back to that where you were talking about the challenges that we face, you know, I'm in rural Appalachia, and my gosh, we have headwinds in terms of economy and parent involvement and whatnot. But in my school, I'm proud to say we have 100% graduation rate 2 years in a row. I teach out of a trailer, you know, so I'm dealing with facility issues and what. But I've got a fully supportive administration from the district level at the school level. I have excellent colleagues. We make it happen for our students every day because we believe in it. And I would not want to give that up for any other job in the world.
This business of engaging students, involving them in the learning process and helping them to discover things on their own as opposed to memorizing and spitting it out on a multiple choice test is something you've talked about, Nancy. In an article you wrote about testing, you talked about the impact that senior projects have on students in terms of morale and in terms of what and how they learn versus simply learning to take the test. Talk about that.
Senior Project, it's a performance-based assessment where students do research papers on a topic of their choice. It's student-driven. They then work in the community on a project for a minimum of 15 hours. They create now a digital portfolio, and then they do a 15-minute oral presentation to a panel of community members. It brings real world into our school. And on that day, I know that our seniors are performing at their best. It is also for every single senior at Mooresville High School. It's not just for those that are in the upper-level courses.
You are a principal, Doyle, and you have stressed the need for more teacher leaders. This is a concept, I think, that comes from the Center for Teaching Quality. As a principal, why do you want more leaders? Because aren't they going to challenge you?
Because I don't know all the answers. And so I've always been one that's wanted more heads thinking about a situation than just mine. So I will be the first one to tell you that I do not all know all the answers. So when you build that relationship with your teachers of mutual respect, then you get a better product in the end.
Is it difficult to hire good teachers and retain good teachers, given what's going on in North Carolina in the last several years?
It is very difficult. I spend most of my summer dealing with the hiring process, especially in the areas of math and science and special ed. I don't think the state has made it attractive to people to enter the teaching profession. And so once we get them, I think they feel valued and supported in our school and our district. The hard part is getting teachers coming out of college wanting to major in education.
I'm sorry that's all the time we have. We could go on for hours with this. Doyle Nicholson is the principal at Davie County High School. Thank you for coming all this way. And thank you, Ben Carey Owens, for coming all this way from Tri-County Early College High up in the mountains. Nancy Gardner is a teacherpreneur at the Center for Teaching Quality and in the Mooresville Graded Schools. And Joanna Scamizzi is a biology teacher at Independence High.
Charlotte Talks with Mike.